This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Wednesday, February the 11th, 2026. As is my custom, we're going to start in the world section and work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So we'll get right into it. First off, from today's world section of the Monitor, the headline reads, "We were buzzing. U.S. women's ice hockey team shuts out rival Canada." For the first time in Olympic history, Canada failed to score a goal in a women's ice hockey match. The rivals met in a 2026 Winter Olympics match, February 10th in Milan, Italy, that ended with a 5-0 victory for the United States. The date on this particular article is February the 11th, 2026, and it is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at the Monitor. The dateline is Milan, Italy. There were signs this was coming, more than signs, really, alarm bells, air raid sirens. But there was still something almost otherworldly about watching it unfold. On Tuesday, the United States defeated Canada 5-0 in women's hockey's most heated rivalry. And the game in the 2026 Winter Olympics women's ice hockey preliminary round wasn't as close as the score indicated. The U.S. women dominated in every conceivable way. Speed through the neutral zone, board battles, zone exits, goaltending, puck movement, you name it, the Americans were decisively better. This is what the U.S. and Canada usually do to all the other teams in women's hockey, almost never to each other, and certainly not in the Olympics. Before Tuesday, the most lopsided victory in the Olympic rivalry was a 7-4 U.S. win in the preliminary rounds of the 1998 Nagano Games. But late last year, in the traditional pre-Olympic rivalry series, the U.S. made a statement. It won all four games by a combined score of 24-7. Yet surely it couldn't happen again here. It did. And for the first time in Olympic history, Canada failed to score a goal. Now Canada is left to wonder what on earth it can do to prevent the U.S. from winning the inevitable gold medal rematch on February the 19th. A U.S. win against Canada there would equal the longest winning streak for either team in the history of the rivalry, 8 games. It is possible that Canada could see the return of its best player, Marie-Philippe Poulin, the consensus greatest player of all time, who was out of the game Tuesday after an injury during the team's 5-1 win over Chechnya on Monday. But for all Ms. Poulin's unquestioned greatness, she also, in some ways, exemplifies how the rivalry has changed so dramatically. Like many of her teammates this year, Ms. Poulin is a veteran who has been through the hockey wars, with more good times than bad against the U.S., frankly. Canada's 5 Olympic golds to America's 2 indicates the historic balance of power, close, yet with a clear tilt. Ms. Poulin has won 3 of those golds, the most recent at the 2022 Beijing Olympics, when Canada defeated the U.S. 3-2. But on the ice Tuesday, the Canadians could not keep up with a hungrier American side. The U.S. has leaned into youth and speed, and the Canadians must have felt like a beehive had fallen on their heads. "We were buzzing. It was fun," grinned American forward Abby Murphy after the game. The shift in power is most obvious in 2 American defenders who each had a goal Tuesday and were the best players on the ice by some margin. Caroline Harvey and Layla Edwards are best friends, teammates, and college roommates at the University of Wisconsin. They also looked like they were playing the game at another level. This is the evolution of sport. Sometimes it happens slowly. Sometimes 2 young women take the game by the scruff of the neck and show the world what's next on a Tuesday night in Milan. If the rivalry has told fans anything, it's that neither side stays down long. The longest period of dominance came from 2004 to 2007, when Canada won 16 of the 20 meetings. That was also the only time the U.S. failed to advance to an Olympic gold medal game, losing to Sweden in the semifinals of the 2006 Turin Olympics. This year's Canadian team is likely not facing that indignity. They've been dominant in their other games so far. Tuesday pointed to something else. It suggested that the U.S. might be a freight train heading express to hockey's future. In next week's final, the U.S. will almost surely have a golden chance to leave no doubt. And again, this particular article is by Mark Sappenfield, who is a senior global correspondent at The Monitor. Continuing on to our second headline from today's World section of The Monitor, this one reads, "On anniversary of revolution, has brutality broken Iran's social contract?" As Iran urges attendance at rallies Wednesday marking the anniversary of the revolution, many citizens could not be further estranged. The date on this particular article is February the 10th. It is by Scott Peterson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is London. The young Iranian man with chiseled features and thick, sculpted hair was passionate about watches, taught his parents watchmaking, and dreamed one day of running his own watch gallery in Tehran. Family videos show Ali Manoucher Abadi smiling while holding a cake at a party. In his studio portrait, he wears a confident look and a shirt depicting medieval Islamic warriors, a clear tribute to past Persian glory and identity. But Mr. Manoucher Abadi's bright future came to an abrupt end on January 8th. Iranian security forces shot him in the head as they moved under the cover of an internet blackout to crush nationwide anti-regime protests with live fire that left thousands dead. The young man's father, a shopkeeper, was protesting alongside his son that night and raced with him to find care. The family later found the 21-year-old's remains among body bags piled at a city morgue. "We will forever seek justice for these martyrs and continue their path for change," says a close relative in Tehran who asked not to be named to minimize the risk of retribution. Iran's two-day crackdown, unprecedented in recent history for its scale, speed, and ferocity, has left Iranians shocked, further solidifying the polarization between so many of the country's citizens and the Islamic Republic that rules their lives. Wednesday marks the 47th anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that toppled the pro-West Shah and, as in every previous year, officials are declaring victory over enemies and have mobilized mass marches. But Iranians say this anniversary resonates like no other. The level of state violence in January has irreversibly torn Iran's social contract, and the government acknowledges it has no solution to the economic crises that triggered the protests. Also casting a pall, Israel and the United States attacked Iran in June, and for more than 2 years since the start of the Gaza War, Israel has systematically downgraded Iran's regional militia allies. Currently, U.S. President Donald Trump has deployed a, quote, massive armada, which he threatens will strike Iran if it does not shackle its strategic nuclear and missile capabilities. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, in a speech recorded at an undisclosed location, apparently due to the risk of U.S. military action, said on Monday the annual marches have been unparalleled in the world. He called upon Iranians to disappoint the enemy with a mass turnout. Mr. Khamenei, whose position is meant to be infallible as God's representative on earth, did not repeat previous claims of protesters engaged in sedition, saying Iranian morality and piousness would show faithfulness to the Islamic Republic. Iran's younger generation bore the brunt of the mass killings carried out by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, and its ideological Basij militia. By Monday, activists confirmed nearly 7,000 deaths, with 11,730 still under investigation. Among them was Mr. Manoucher Abadi, whose family's agony illustrates the depth of Iran's deep divisions. Anyone who can now celebrate the Islamic Republic's 47th birthday, they say, is repugnant. Yet the family refrained from an often used graveside act of protest against Iran's hardline rulers, dancing at a funeral for this young man. Many bereaved families in final shows of defiance that have gone viral online celebrate lost loved ones with forbidden music and dancing instead of traditional tears of Shiite mourning. The family was not asked to pay the notorious bullet fee of $3,500 to retrieve their son, nor to sign a pledge of silence like many others. Nor were they forced to agree to publicly portray their son as a loyalist Basiji, killed while battling Israeli and American-backed terrorist agents, the regime's narrative to justify the killings. But there was a reason they walked silently and broken as they put Mr. Manushir Abadi to rest, says the relatives. We were afraid they might take the body away from us and prevent the burial. I don't even know what I feel. I am numb, she says, adding that no one with a conscience could now take part in the anniversary of 1979. For me, that day is the most hateful day in our history after what happened, says the relative. I see that day as the day of captivity, when the sentence of our enslavement as Iranians has been issued. The contrast could hardly be greater between the fury of grieving families and Iranian authorities, who so far offer no expression of regret for the bloodshed. Instead, they boast of defeating a U.S.-Israeli coup plot. To encourage high rally turnout, state-run television has broadcast steady reports about public enthusiasm for the celebrations. For decades, officials have equated high turnout with a popular vote of confidence. Scenes recently broadcast have promoted attending rallies as a family tradition, with parents recalling great memories and kids waving flags. Of course, I will certainly be there just for our Iran at this critical juncture, says one woman interviewed on the street by a primetime bulletin. Despite all our grievances and complaints, we have a duty to declare allegiance to the country and push away the threat of war. The judiciary might also be coercing rally attendance. Reports are emerging that families of some of the 51,790 Iranians arrested have been told that if they seek leniency, they will be forced to attend the rallies and post videos of their participation. Hardline officials have cast January's deadly crackdown in existential terms and use religious justification. In a speech days after the crackdown, IRGC strategist Hassan Abbasi cited verses from the Quran. Quote, Allah is telling us to kill as many people as possible until the sedition is no more, so that what remains is nothing but God's religion, end quote. What is that sedition here? Well, they martyred clerics, they martyred Basijis, IRGC members, nurses, kids, ordinary people, pure evil, Mr. Abbasi claimed. With the purging of the unbelievers and the corrupt, he averred, society can now breathe. It is cleared up and in relief after their termination. Charges levied against protesters include Moharebet, waging war against God, which can lead to a death sentence. But prominent figures have spoken out against the regime's crackdown. The violence was a great betrayal and crime of revolutionary ideals, wrote former Prime Minister Mir Hossein Mousavi, who has been under house arrest for leading the Green Movement protesters against the stolen 2009 elections, which he was set to win. In what language should people say that they do not want this Islamic Republic system and do not believe your lies? Enough is enough. The game is over. Your acts of oppression have caught up with you, Mr. Mousavi wrote on January 30th in a rare statement. When you put on battle dress against your own nation, you are striking an axe at your own roots, he wrote. Your turn has come. Nothing will remain of you but a story full of blood and violence. Videos persist of funerals in which mourners chant, Khamenei is a murderer. His rule is illegitimate. This is the year of blood. Sayed Ali Khamenei will be toppled. No doubt these protests are a new form in the expression of fury, and what do you expect? People in my city are extremely poor, says one protester from the western city of Karambabad, who asked that his name not be used. We thought the time had come, and this can't go on forever, says the protester, who describes regime forces provoking demonstrators, even in the most peaceful rallies, and witnessing two Basiji militiamen smashing an ATM machine. It's hard to say if some people will ever find an off-ramp from what they went through, he says. A relative of his wife lost a brother and a cousin, and their families will be carrying this pain with them forever. For now, the regime is celebrating its victory over us, the Israeli mercenaries. But honestly, can they sell themselves the same story and believe it? Asks the protester. They know that the gap will never, ever be bridged again. They will be dealing with a much more alienated society, he concludes. We will never be the same as who we were before. And a note here that an Iranian researcher contributed to this report, which was written by Scott Peterson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. And here's our third headline from today's World section of The Monitor. There's a bit of an Olympic focus today. The headline reads, I get to be here. Olympic slope-style skiers come for the tricks and leave with joy. For athletes competed in Olympic slope-style skiing, which includes skiing down rails, performing flips and turns, face plants are part of the experience. But so are creativity and joy. The date on this article is February the 10th. It is by Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is Livigno, Italy. Right at the start, it's a backflip onto a rail for Swedish skier Jesper Jäder. Things are looking good for his second run down the course at Livigno Snow Park in the men's slopestyle final. Then, off the second rail, he teeters backwards into the snow. The crowd groans. Slopestyle skiers get three runs down the course and then take their best score of the three. So in a competition like the Olympics, that's enough to make this run a throwaway. But Mr. Jäder doesn't throw it away. He skis over to the side of the course, reclips his ski boots, and then tucks down for speed before flying off a jump to twist and turn this way and that, again and again. It's just another day on a snowy playground for Mr. Jäder, who also happens to hold the world's record for the longest rail ski. It's not just Mr. Jäder who flubs and then flies. The conditions weren't optimal for the men's slopestyle final on Tuesday afternoon. There were what skiers call a flat light, which eliminates shadows and makes it hard to manage your vision in the air while you're flipping around, says gold medalist Birk Ruud of Norway. The rails themselves at the top of the course are particularly tricky, tall, long, and extra zigzaggy. After winning the silver medal, U.S. freestyle skier Alex Hall called it probably the hardest rail course I've ever skied, and I think a lot of us have ever skied. Luca Harrington of New Zealand, who took home his first Olympic medal with a bronze, reflected on the technical aspects of keeping skis on rails through this course. These things are a couple of meters off the ground. They're impressive to look at, and they're a lot longer, he says. This usually means it's a lot more challenging to make it to the end, especially while doing spin-ins, spin-on, spin-offs. So that's been a fun surprise. All of this meant that several skiers were hit with an Olympic-sized disappointment right at the start of their runs. But after stumbling, skier after skier tightened their boots, collected loose skis, and proceeded to do tricks that those of us at the bottom feel weak need to even watch. Even when Mr. Ruud knew he had won the gold before his last trip down the slope, he couldn't help himself. He proceeded to flip his way down what was supposed to be a victory lap and face-planted off a rail along the way. For the men flying through the air at the Livigno Snow Park, on Tuesday afternoon, joy was the point. For me, that's almost everything, Mr. Jäder said, told the Monitor in an interview after coming in fifth. Medals are for sure fun, and it's a bonus, but I wouldn't say that's the main reason I'm here. I'm here to have fun and show my skiing. At the Olympics, you want to show your best tricks. For some, carrying on was strategic. The course is judged in sections, so depending on the size of the mistake, doing well in other sections could still earn a score that, while not podium-worthy, could move them up in the standings. Others use a fumbled run as practice for ones to come through a scoring system that's intended to encourage creativity. Even if that particular run has no chance for a winning score, you can still get a feeling of the course for the next run, says Norwegian skier Sebastian Schjerve, who has stood atop a World Cup podium 3 times. Maybe try to do something cool just for the crowd and people watching at home, he adds with a smile. And also, it's about fun. I can't come this far and be like, ah, screw it, says Austrian skier Matej Schwanzer, a flashy competitor in big air and slopestyle who won a World Cup title in 2025. He made headlines in January when his ski popped off at the top of a run at the World Cup in Switzerland, but he still stuck the landing on one ski and placed second. In Livigno, he finished 7th, but that hardly matters, almost, to these masters of innovation. I'm going to give it my all because that's what I've been training for, says Mr. Schwanzer. For U.S. skier Connor Ralph, the thrill of competing in his first Winter Olympics softened any disappointment in a 9th-place finish. I'm super bummed, obviously, said Mr. Ralph through a smile, but I get to be here. The games and the fun aren't over yet. Mr. Ralph and the rest of the slopestyle skiers will also compete in the men's freestyle big air qualifying rounds on Sunday. And again, this particular article is by Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Still in today's world section of The Monitor, the next headline reads, Bangladesh ousted an autocrat in 2024. Can it pull off a democratic reset now? After mass protests in Bangladesh overthrew former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, some of the interim government's lofty goals have fallen short. But upcoming elections are a chance to chart a new path. This particular article is by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is Thakurgarayon, Bangladesh. The sun is setting behind the mahogany trees in the schoolyard when the candidate rises to speak. Above him, lashed to the canopy of the stage, over the stage, hang sheaves of unhusked rice, the symbol of the Bangladesh Nationalist Party. Misra Fakhrul Alamgir, the BNP's Secretary General, is a veteran of Bangladesh's turbulent politics. This is his 16th campaign stop of the day, another chance to plug his party and his candidacy in Thakurgarayon, his parliamentary district. But first, he wants to remind the hundreds of men, women, and children sitting in rows of plastic chairs why this election is different. This time, we will cast our own votes, he says. Our own votes. After 15 years of one-party rule legitimized by sham elections, the promise that votes will be cast and counted fairly is a potent one. The February 12th election is seen as a crucial step toward a restoration of multi-party democracy in Bangladesh and a marker of how far it has come since a student-led uprising in the summer of 2024 drew global attention. The uprising, which was brutally suppressed by Bangladesh security forces and paramilitaries with the loss of at least 1,400 lives, unseated Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, who had been in power since 2009. In August 2024, she fled into exile in India, leaving behind a shaken country and a brittle economy that an interim civilian administration has struggled at times to govern. Now that the interim government, installed with support from student activists and the military, is holding an election to select a 350-member parliament that will form a new government. Voters will also be asked to approve a set of constitutional reforms that are designed to guard against autocratic backsliding and codify some of the demands for change that emerged from the uprising. These include term limits for lawmakers, a more powerful presidency to check the prime minister's authority, and measures to counter corruption and conflicts of interest. The reforms were hashed out by leaders from across the political spectrum, an achievement by itself, given the internecine politics of a country whose bloody birth in 1971 remains a contested history. But, as the United States has found out, checks and balances in a political system only matter as far as politicians feel bound by the rules and norms put in place. We all recognize the fact that no matter how many reforms are undertaken in the electoral space, if the political parties don't themselves reform in the right direction, it's going to be tough, says Mir Nadia Niven, who chaired the interim government's Electoral Reform Commission. On the streets near Dhaka University, the epicenter of the 2024 uprising, walls painted with anti-regime artworks are starting to fade. A new banknote issued this week features an image of a student protester, but that feels to some like a fallen star from an unfulfilled revolution. The feeling is quite mixed. I don't feel that we're in a good situation, says Simon Naoshin Suga, who is studying Japanese at Dhaka University. Looking back, she says, we thought Bangladesh would become a better place. Now she worries about mob violence in Dhaka and other cities and rising religious intolerance against non-Muslims, which an interim government has often been reluctant to confront. Ms. Niven, a former UN official who worked in Myanmar and Afghanistan, says the Arab Spring is a reminder of how street movements that coalesce to end a regime don't always pan out. The Bermuda Triangle of all successful youth-led or mass movement revolutions is post-revolution when you're making the democratic transition, she says. Bangladesh became the first in a series of Generation Z-led protests in 2024 and 2025, ranging from Peru to Indonesia. Many borrowed inspiration and tactics from other movements, becoming a sort of chain reaction carried by online activism. Not all succeeded, as Bangladesh's movement did in bringing down a government. But in Nepal, anti-government protests last September did force a change at the top. A similar rupture took Sri Lanka in 2022, forcing out a president from a powerful family who had fumbled an economic crisis. In all three South Asian countries, say analysts, anger at the political class was fueled by a lack of economic opportunities in a system seen as rigged by insiders. Bangladesh's protests began over political patronage in government hiring of graduates. Nepal is holding elections next month under a caretaker government led by a judge. That's a much quicker turnaround than in Bangladesh, says Paul Staniland, a political scientist at the University of Chicago who studies South Asia. The idea was to find some stability and political order and then try a partial reset, he says. Bangladesh's interim government took a different path. They didn't really have an electoral mandate, but also they wanted to do these very broad-reaching and politically controversial things, says Professor Saniland. The demand for root and branch reforms ran into headwinds, though, as the economy sputtered and public disorder surged. Still, polls suggest that Bangladeshi voters are optimistic overall about the political transition. An International Republican Institute poll of nearly 5,000 adults taken in the fall found 70% approval of the interim government. Compared with an April 2023 poll, the proportion who said the country was going in the right direction rose from 44% to 53%. 9 in 10 respondents said they would vote in Thursday's election. The last time Bangladesh held a multi-party election that was judged as fair and free was in 2008. In a country of 175 million and where about half the population is under 30, this means tens of millions of eligible voters have never known a credible election. Its 127 million registered voters also include Bangladeshis who live overseas and have been allowed to cast postal ballots for the first time. For young voters, this is a new experience for them. They're quite excited to cast their vote, says Mr. Almagir, the BNP official, in an interview between campaign stops. He was first elected in 2001 in his home district in northern Bangladesh near the Indian border, where he taught economics at university. After 2008, the seat was held by Ms. Hasina's Awami League. Its most recent occupant was jailed over his alleged role in the 2024 crackdown. The interim government has barred the Awami League from contesting this election, a decision that has benefited the BNP as the largest opposition party. Mr. Almaguer served as a minister in a BNP government led by the late Khaleda Zia, the bitter rival of Ms. Hasina, and, like her, the scion of a political dynasty. Now, the party leadership has passed to Ms. Zia's son, Tariq Rahman, who returned to Bangladesh in December after living in Britain for 17 years. Ms. Zia died on December 30th. Mr. Rahman left under a cloud of corruption allegations that he said were politically motivated. Since the fall of Ms. Hasina, all charges against him have been dropped, paving the way for him to stage a triumphant homecoming. He is widely seen as the frontrunner to be Bangladesh's next prime minister. Mr. Almaguer admits that the BNP failed in the past to prevent corruption, but says that this will change as political reforms take root. What we need is democracy to function, he says, noting that it is Parliament's job to hold parties accountable. More than 50 parties are registered for the election, which will also feature more than 200 independent candidates, including a former beauty queen and a campaigner for urban sanitation. But the BNP's main competitor is Jamaat el Islami, a right-wing Islamist party that was suppressed under Ms. Hasina. It has formed an 11-party alliance to contest the election. In the IRI poll, 33% of very likely voters said they would choose BNP ahead of 29% who supported Jamaat, while 18% said they didn't know or declined to say. The Jamaat-led alliance includes the National Citizens Party, founded last year by students who led the 2024 uprising. Its decision to join caused an uproar as women in particular objected to an alliance with conservative Islamists and accused its leaders of betraying the party's progressive ideals. Several prominent women quit, and some are running as independents. The NCP has defended its decision as pragmatic because it lacked the support to win many seats on its own. The fallout shows how hard it is to build a party out of a movement led by activists of different political stripes, says Takbir Huda, a human rights lawyer. To succeed, he says, you really need to ideologically align on a project that is prescriptive and not just disruptive. The absence of the Awami League, a fixture of Bangladeshi politics since the country's founding, has raised questions about how its supporters will vote and how many will stay home. In public comments, Ms. Hasina has railed against the interim government and rejected calls to accept responsibility for the bloodshed during the uprising. In November, she was sentenced to death in absentia by a court in Bangladesh for her role in the killings. India declined to extradite her to stand trial, which has strained that country's diplomatic relations with Bangladesh. A source close to the former ruling family said the Awami League knows it has no electoral future until it moves on from Ms. Hasina, but she has resisted the idea of naming a successor even after her conviction made it almost impossible for her to return home. She still thinks she's the prime minister, says the source, who didn't want to be named for fear of being ostracized. The day after his rallies, Mr. Almaguer headed to Dhaka, an 8-hour drive. There, he stood on stage with Mr. Rahman for the launch of the BNP's manifesto, which includes promises to create jobs, improve governance, and support farmers. Parties have put more stock in promoting their manifestos in this election than in the past, an indicator, say analysts, that voters now expect tangible results from their political representatives. At a river sluice gate outside Thukarakgaon, locals gather near sunset to take photos and eat snacks. The whirly gig of national politics and the imminent election feel distant. Mohammed Shuvo, a second-year philosophy student, buys a pack of nuts from a vendor. He plans to vote for the NCP in the election, which will be his second. The last one in 2024, his only option, was the Awami League. Today, he sees a real choice on the ballot and a chance for Bangladesh to deliver on the promises of the 2024 reform movement in which he participated. Now I have the freedom to vote, he says. I can also speak freely about it. And this, again, article is by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. And here's one final article from today's World section, once again Olympics focused. So the headline reads, "The Ilya Malinin Dilemma. Are tricks trumping artistry at the Winter Olympics?" A new Olympic scoring system at the 2026 Milan Cortina Games is encouraging advances in athletic achievement across freestyle skiing, snowboarding, and skating events. The date on this particular article is February the 10th. It is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at the Monitor, and Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. And the dateline is Milan and Livigno, Italy. On Tuesday, Ilya Malinin and his perfect hair will attempt a figure skating routine that could well be confused for a Marvel movie. With the U.S. skaters' quadruple rotation leaps, contorted spins, and the combustion of a full backflip, spectators will need only a tub of popcorn to believe they have slipped into a summer blockbuster. This has been the way of figure skating since chronic judging scandals made the sport swap the inscrutabilities of artistry for the relative precision of athleticism. Every Olympics is a new frontier in the race for more points. Who can crowbar the most high-scoring elements into a routine to push their competitors into numerical submission? Artistry? Just wave your arms a bit and call it good. That's an overstatement, but Mr. Malinin's routine is so unfathomably full of high-scoring elements that he doesn't even need to skate it particularly well to win, as happened in the team event on Sunday when the United States took home the gold. Is this how it should be? The Olympics, after all, are for sports, and the new scoring system is encouraging quantum leaps in athletics and athletic achievement. But the question echoes beyond figure skating. In freestyle skiing and snowboarding, too, does the thirst for the next big trick sap some of the game's joy? Or is it the very heart of the Olympics, faster, higher, stronger? Curiously, freestyle skiing and snowboarding have approached this question in almost exactly the opposite way from figure skating. From the moment snowboarding entered the Olympics in 1998, the athletes put down a marker. They wanted the sport, even at the Olympic level, to be an expression of creativity and freedom. As a practical matter, that meant insisting on multiple runs with the winner being the one completing the best single run, not a combination of multiple runs. That allowed skiers and snowboarders to try things and make mistakes on one run without a bobble being necessarily fatal to their chances of winning. And try things they do. U.S. freestyle skier Alex Hall's gold medal slopestyle run in Beijing in 2022, he made one of his jumps off a mound of snow that everyone else ignored. It wasn't even intended as an element of the course, but his spontaneity brought a creative flair. On the final jump, he launched a right double cork 1080 pretzel, which involves stopping the trick midair and reversing the direction of the spin. I love variety, so I love doing events with weird jumps and weird takeoffs, he said during the news conference after this year's games. That spirit of adventure is deeply sewn into the sport. Mr. Hall is famous for his 200,000 Instagram followers, to his 200,000 Instagram followers for driving his van between events so he can stop and ski cities. Yes, the critics, the cities themselves. He can at times spend hours a day scourging Google Earth for stairs and railings and concrete walls to turn into a freestyle skiing playground. You look at it as a canvas that's not meant to be skied on, and it frees you to do that differently, he said at a media event in October. Other skiers and snowboarders head into the backcountry where the terrain offers seemingly endless interpretations. It's good for me to have that other thing we can put our minds to and bring that inspiration back to our sport, says American Colby Stevenson, a Big Air silver medalist in Beijing who missed out on the Milan Cortina team. You work with the terrain. How is the mountain telling you how to do the jumps? For many of these athletes, developing a new trick is a progression. Nick Goper, a slopestyle skier turned half-pipe skier at Milan Cortina trains on the jumps he built at his rollerblade ranch in the Utah desert. That includes an airbag he imported from Canada and classified as a gift so he wouldn't get in trouble with customs, he said, with a laugh at the October media event. Fellow half-pipe skier Alex Ferreira describes his process as a five-step program that starts with ideation. After developing a trick in his head, he tested out on the trampoline, then by rollerblading into a foam pit, and then tries the trick with an airbag before finally bringing it to the snow. Some steps can take 2 days, some steps take 2 years, and I've been stuck in all different types of steps, Mr. Ferreira said in October. Definitely a lot of trial and error. The airbags, or vert bags, have become essential for learning today's tricks, but not without some controversy. When the tricks get so advanced and require such advanced facilities to perform them, I think it shrinks the pool of potential participants on the development level, Mr. Goper said last fall. Stevenson agreed that pushing tricks too far can have negative consequences. We're at a turning point, he said at the October media event. The youth have always been pushing the limits, but they're almost maxing out, especially with the size of the jumps. Our sport isn't just about doing the next biggest spin, he adds. It's the creativity side of it. Jason Brown has been saying this about figure skating for years. Twice an Olympian in 2014 and 2022, and twice as an alternate, 2018 and this year, he says that skaters need to take a stand for artistry. When it comes to the single event, I want to prove to the next generation and the skating fan and the skating community that quality and integrity and the artistic side of the sport matters, he said in an October media event. That means giving more points to the elements that are not jumps, from spins to footwork. The top scoring jump, for example, can get 12.5 points. The top spin maxes out at 4 points. It sends the message to athletes, I don't really need to work on my spins that much because of the points, Mr. Brown said. The challenge figure skating faces is the murky legacy of artistic scores. In the famously opaque 6.0 score system, it was common knowledge that judges would pump up artistry scores for skaters they liked. Artistry is still an element of the new scoring system, but significantly diminished. That makes winning largely a matter of mathematics, exactly what snowboarding and freestyling skiing wanted to avoid. Then again, the scoring in figure skating is vastly more scrutinized than in snowboarding and freestyle skiing. In the end, Mr. Malinin did not think it needs to be an either-or debate. I always tell people that figure skating is an extension of your personality and everyone should have that in their skating, he said at a pre-games news conference. That is what can make skating so beautiful and intimate. For those people who enjoy doing backflips and skating to different music, it is something everyone can bring in their own personality, he added. And besides, this tension has existed for decades. The Winter Games have always been an alchemical combination of crash, bang, pow, and ineffable grace. The question of whether big tricks are taking over is simply a part of the sport's evolution. It's almost like saying you no longer like your hometown because people just keep moving into it. But there's not a lot you can do to stop it, says Mr. Goper, the freestyle skier at the October media event. It's sort of like beat 'em. If you can't beat 'em, join 'em. And again, this particular article is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor, and Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move on to the USA section of today's Monitor and pick up as many articles as we can. So our first headline from the USA section reads, "What is the Save America Act and how could it change U.S. voting?" Republicans in Congress have a new strategy to advance the Save America Act, which would significantly change how Americans vote in federal elections. The date on this article is February the 10th. It is by Caitlin Babcock, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Republicans in Congress are pushing to pass a bill that would impose new requirements on people registering to vote, and it could affect people updating their registrations. The House of Representatives is expected to vote Wednesday, that's today, on the Save America Act, which would require people to show proof of citizenship to register to vote in federal elections, and a government-issued photo ID that proves citizenship to cast a ballot. The requirements are widely popular among Americans, but are strongly opposed by Democrats who say they would prevent millions from voting. The bill has been a priority of Republicans for years. They say it's necessary to stop non-citizens from registering and voting, something data shows does occur but is rare enough not to influence election outcomes. The latest iteration comes at a time when the Trump administration, which supports the bill, has criticized the integrity of America's elections ahead of this year's congressional midterms. President Donald Trump has made similar criticisms ahead of other presidential elections. On January 28th, the FBI moved to seize cast ballots and other 2020 voting records from an election center in Fulton County, Georgia. In recent months, the Justice Department has demanded complete voter registration lists from almost every state. Roughly two dozen states have rejected this request. Many states prohibit the disclosure of voter data without a court order. On Sunday, Mr. Trump called on Republicans in Congress to fight for the Save America Act. Despite his claim of a, quote, stolen election, no evidence of fraud has surfaced that would call into question the results of the 2020 election, which Mr. Trump lost to Joe Biden. The bill, the Save America Act, the bill is the latest version of the Save America Act, properly known as the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act, which passed the House in April but stalled in the Senate. Under the bill, most people would need a passport or birth certificate to register to vote. Additional options include military IDs and records of service, as well as enhanced driver's licenses offered in a handful of states. People who submit voter registration forms by mail would still need to present proof of citizenship in person. The bill also requires people to present a photo ID that indicates citizenship to cast their ballots. 36 states have some form of voter ID law, but the Save America Act would impose stricter provisions than most of those laws, according to experts. People could still vote by absentee ballot in federal elections if they attached a copy of an acceptable photo ID to their ballot request and submission forms. Most Americans approve of the bill's core provisions. In a 2024 Gallup poll, 84% of respondents support requiring voters to present a photo ID at their voting places, and 83% supported requiring proof of citizenship to register to vote. Walter Olson, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, says voter ID laws tend to make little impact. Studies show they have neither greatly reduced fraud nor caused wide-scale disenfranchisement. But Mr. Olson says requiring people to show documents proving they're citizens when registering to vote puts a greater burden on potential voters and could be have unintended consequences. For example, election workers could face criminal penalties under the proposed law if they register someone who fails to present documentary proof of citizenship. The law also directs states to devise a way to verify people's citizenship if they can't access the required documents. Because that process could create vagaries and complications for election workers, it might be easier and less risky to just say no. The practical effect is to instill a big old bias toward not accepting documents, says Mr. Olson. In January, Republican Representative Anna Paulina Luna of Florida and Tim Burchett of Tennessee threatened to vote against passing a government funding package unless the Save America Act was attached. Both backed down after pressure from the White House. If it passes the House this week, the bill is expected to stall in the Senate, where it would need at least seven Democratic votes to break a filibuster. Ms. Luna plans to try to attach the measure to a must-pass intelligence funding bill in April. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York calls the provision dead on arrival. Democrats say the bill is unnecessary given that it is already illegal and rare for non-citizens to vote in federal elections, according to organizations including the Brennan Center and the Center for Election Innovation and Research. Democrats also worry it will disenfranchise voters who can't access documents that prove citizenship. A 2024 Brennan Center survey found 9% of Americans of voting age either didn't possess documents to prove their citizenship or didn't have them readily available. Experts say those most likely to be affected include conservative would-be voters who are less likely than Democrats to hold a passport. Conservative women are also more likely to change their last names when they marry, creating complications when using a birth certificate as identification. The bill's opponents also say its requirement to present proof of citizenship in person could disproportionately affect certain groups. For example, says Greta Bedakovic, the director of democracy at the Center for American Progress, would-be voters in rural states might have to drive long distances simply to register to vote. She worries it would leave staffers in many election offices completely overwhelmed. Republicans such as Ms. Luna say the bill is needed to protect the rights of American voters. Both parties do have a vested interest in making sure that all eligible citizens and only eligible citizens can register and vote in federal elections, says Rachel Ori, director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Election Project. It's an integrity measure, and it's also a voter protection measure. That said, Ori worries the Save America Act could create new barriers for eligible voters. They cite a study that found that a three-year proof of citizenship mandate in Kansas barred more than 35,000 people from the state's rolls. President Trump has repeatedly claimed, without evidence, that widespread voter fraud caused his loss in 2020. Last March, he signed an executive order requiring documentary proof of citizenship for voter registration. But large portions of that order have since been blocked by federal judges after multiple states and voting rights groups sued. In an interview last week, Mr. Trump accused 15 unnamed states of being crooked and urged Republicans in Congress to take over voting procedures in these states and nationalize the voting. He also said last week that if states can't run elections, Congress should step in. No evidence has emerged to back his claims about states' abilities to run fair elections. Under the Constitution, states are primarily responsible for governing elections. Some experts on election integrity are voicing concerns that the president is laying the groundwork for efforts to pressure state election systems in his own party's advantage this fall or to challenge some midterm outcomes that don't go Republicans' way. For anybody who doubted that this administration is laying the foundation to interfere in elections, the deluge of activity over the last 2 weeks should lay those doubts to rest, Wendy Weiser, vice president for democracy at the Brennan Center for Justice, told Vox on Monday. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt has said the president's comments referred to his desire for Congress to pass the Save America Act. The president never referenced the bill, which does not contain specific language about nationalizing elections. And again, this particular article is by Caitlin Babcock, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, we're going to jump over to the editorial section of today's Monitor and pick up an editorial or two. So our first editorial, the headline reads, Africa's Bid for Mineral Mastery. Thousands of global executives and government officials have flocked to a Cape Town mining conference this week. African leaders aim to respond to their interests with a unified approach that upholds the continent's sovereignty and development. The date on this article or this comment is February the 10th. It is by the Monitor's editorial board. Nearly 150 years ago, rivalry among European powers set off a scramble for Africa that led to a century of colonial rule and a complicated legacy of dependency on foreign aid and technology. Now, booming global demand for rare earth elements and minerals has set off another scramble toward the continent. But this time, Africa's sovereign governments have the opportunity to steer the interaction toward priorities that increase benefits to their citizens through less lopsided investment terms. Africa is no longer merely a supplier, but central to global mineral diplomacy, according to Shaku Wani, an analyst at the London School of Economics International Growth Center. The interest of external players, he pointed out, brings leverage for Africa, but only if it is managed with purpose. This week's annual Mining Indaba conference in Cape Town, South Africa, highlights the potential for African states to act in partnership in their extractive industries. Thousands of government officials, mining executives, and global investors from Asia, Europe, the Americas, and the continent are attending. The United States, despite its fractious relationship with the host country all last year, has reportedly sent its largest delegation ever to this event. The world's major economies are competing for access to critical minerals used in modern technology, from smartphones and electric vehicles to computing and artificial intelligence. Africa's estimated reserves include cobalt, 55% of known world deposits, manganese, nearly 48% of global supply, platinum, 90%, graphite, copper, nickel, and lithium. Referencing rising resource tensions and the conference theme, Stronger Together, Progress Through Partnership, South Africa's Minerals Minister, Gwede Mantashe, observed, "To us, this is not merely a slogan. It is a strategic imperative for Africa to act collectively, speak in one voice, in our engagement with global powers and investors." One effort to shape unified economic and governance approaches took place last June as African leaders gathered in Morocco for a three-day session on improving financial autonomy and accountability. Corruption and inefficient regulations and infrastructure have long constrained economic growth across Africa. Sudanese British businessman and philanthropist Mo Ibrahim, whose foundation hosted the event, called for building solutions from within, and Pedro Pires, former president of Cape Verde, stressed the need for having confidence in your own institutions to effectively manage natural resources and wealth. A recently issued regional critical minerals framework, which calls for growing and spreading mining and processing activities across different African countries, also highlighted the importance of being able to operate under strong and fair rules. The current flurry of across-continental discussions and global attention signals an opportunity for African nations to put their commitment to rule-based governance into practice. As Dr. Ibrahim told colleagues in June, "It is for us to take responsibility and put in place the fundamentals we need." And again, that is a commentary by the Monitor's editorial board. With that, we're going to quickly jump over to the book section and just pick up a couple of the Monitor's favorite books for the month of January. These are fiction books. One is The Bookbinder's Secret by A.D. Bell. In 1901, Oxford bookbinding apprentice Lily Delaney happens upon a historical mystery. A 50-year-old burned letter sets in motion a thrilling search for more messages tucked inside books, with Lily determined to pursue the truth behind a story of lost riches, hidden love, and murder. Bibliophiles will enjoy this one, and that review is by Stephanie Milligan. Another one, Virgil by George Sanders. George Sanders' slim novel offers a slice of final reckoning pie with a dollop of beauty and a sprinkle of nuts. A malicious oil tycoon shuffling off this mortal coil finds himself under the kind and gracious care of an incorporeal young woman assigned to his case. The bully rails, the comforter mostly listens, and the prose dazzles. There are weird moments, and it's all worth it. And that review is by Aaron Douglas. And next, Murder at World's End by Ross Montgomery. Amid fears of the apocalypse, the return of Halley's Comet in 1910, house servants are instructed to board up a Cornwall manor. But murder is afoot. It's a delightful, quirky, locked-room mystery. And that, again, is Stephanie Milligan's review. Or how about The Sea Child by Linda Wilgus? At age 4, Isabel Henley was found soaked and silent on an English beach. Years later, as a destitute war widow, she returns to investigate her mysterious past. Local gossips believe she's the daughter of a sea spirit. Isabel takes in a wounded sea captain, then embarks on ocean adventures with dangerous smugglers in this action-packed romantic tale. Again, Stephanie Milligan. And with that, we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you spending some of your day with me today, listening to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I'll be back with more from the Christian Science Monitor for you at the end of the week, which actually this week is tomorrow. And in the meantime, I thank you for listening.